It snowed throughout the night, slow and steady, and early in the morning when Hancock left his tent, the ground was covered with a thin white blanket. It had been 2 weeks, and the pontoons had still not come. The word came from Burnside to just sit and wait. Hancock walked downhill toward the river. He saw a thin glaze on the water, the first signs of ice, thought, if we wait long enough, we can walk across. The hill had a layer of snow, and he stopped, admired it as he would a painting, a beautiful scene. Above him, upriver, there was some rough water, a few rocks breaking the smooth flow. He stopped, saw something moving among the rocks, waited, and now he could see. It was a cow. Several more cows moved into the water on the far side, breaking through the thin ice as they moved out into the middle of the river. The first one had reached the near bank, climbed up through the black mud, disappeared into thick grass and short trees. He watched the others, watched the depth of the water, saw they did not go down more than 3 feet, and he turned, ran back up through the snow toward the headquarters of General Couch. As soon as he told him the news, Couch leapt up from a breakfast of pancakes and accompanied him to Sumner's quarters in a stately home that had once belonged to the family of George Washington. They entered the house, and Hancock caught the strong smell of cigar smoke. Standing in the middle of the main living room among a cluster of clean blue coats was General Burnside. Couch said, "Excuse us, General. We did not know you were here. We came to see General Sumner. General Hancock has some information you may find useful." Burnside looked at Hancock, held out his hand, said,
"Yes, General Hancock, a pleasure. Please, gentlemen, let's go this way. I just left General Sumner in his office."
Sumner seemed annoyed at the interruption.
"What is it, Couch?"
"Sir, General Hancock reports that it is possible to ford the river, upstream a short distance. With your permission, we could begin moving the men right away." Sumner stared at Couch with no expression, and Burnside chuckled quietly, said,
"General Hancock, I certainly appreciate your efforts at reconnaissance, but the possibility has been considered and rejected. We will cross the river when the bridges arrive and not before."
Lee straightened his stiff legs, stood high in the stirrups, the big gray horse not moving under him. The hill around him was mostly bare. A few trees broke the clean snow, and in front of him the slope was steep, dropping away toward the town. He could see clearly, see it all, the wide gap of open land the attackers would have to cross, broken only by a few fences and one deep canal, which would disrupt any quick advance of troops. Fredericksburg itself was spread out against the edge of the river, and he knew he would not hold it. It had no value to the army, but even if he had wanted to, the Federal cannon were massed across the river, on top of the long rise known as Stafford Heights, perched high above the river, and so would control any movement in the town and make any defense there impossible. No, it was back here, these hills. He looked around, saw the troops working, dirt and snow flying. A few trees felled and moved into place. Across the Rappahannock on the far hills, he saw the camps, the masses of blue, and could see some movement, though not much detail. The heights were nearly a mile away, and the only real clear image was the house, the mansion, the ancestral home of George Washington, where Lee had courted his wife Mary 30 years earlier. He focused again, looked back down to the open ground, saw a deep roadbed, a long stone wall that ran along the base of the hill. Surely, he thought, they will not do it here, not here. He looked to his right, to the south, along the ridge of the hills, saw his men working far into the distance, digging in. This is too perfect. He felt a nagging sense of alarm. No, it will not happen here. Burnside is not a fool. But there they sit across the river, a great assembled force, and they are not moving. The Federal army had marched with uncharacteristic speed, had surprised him, slipping down the river this far. He hadn't expected the fight to be here, had waited for them to come at him from farther upriver, crossing at the shallow fords to the north. But Jeb Stuart, now a general, with an outstanding ability to track the enemy's moves, followed their advance down to Falmouth, and they continued to move south, reaching the hills across from Fredericksburg a full day before Lee could move any troops here. Lee then quickly brought Longstreet's corps to these hills, and now Jackson had been recalled from the valley and was on the march. Everything pointed to one conclusion. Burnside's plan was to fight here. And we have the good ground, Lee thought. Longstreet's corps had grown to nearly 40,000 men, its greatest strength of the war. But Burnside had nearly three times that, and Lee knew that if they came across the river soon, even the good ground would not be enough. Above Stafford Heights he saw something, the sun reflecting off an object high in the air. He had heard of the balloons, the new observation platforms held aloft by the big bags of hydrogen. And now he saw more of them downriver, and he knew they were watching him, knew by now he was digging in. He shook his head. They were waiting for what? Does Burnside think I will attack him? He wondered. He saw horses climbing up toward him, saw his eager young aide, Lieutenant Walter Taylor, and another man, a red hat, artillery. It was Colonel Porter Alexander.
General Lee, a fine day, sir.
It appears so, Colonel. What do you think of this position?
Alexander smiled.
General, we have positioned guns to cover every inch of the open ground. If they try to cross that canal, it will slow them down, and we will hit them from every angle.
Sir, a chicken could not live on that field.